The Making of the Modern World. This is a talk given to a group of amateur historians at Grimsby in 2002. I had previously visited them to talk 6 years before about my book, The Savage Wars of Peace, just before its publication. And this is a chance to talk about subsequent work after that, and to reflect on what I've done since. My Savage Wars of Peace was like Captain Cook's first voyage. Since then I've made four more voyages, which I can briefly sketch in. The common theme to all this work over those years is that of exploring the origins of the modern world. The first questions I asked as a historian in my sixth form with Andrew Morgan. The question, in other words, of how and why the modern world, a compound of capitalism, individualism, industrialism, democracy, and many other features emerged, and why it did so first in Western Europe. That is a question which has pursued me, or I have pursued it, for all my adult life, and a brief account of the exploration will be given below. Our world is peculiar, unexpected, unforeseen, undesigned. How, against all the odds, did it occur and establish a new kind of civilization? The first voyage, The Savage Wars of Peace. This book seeks to explain in some detail how the two islands of England and Japan broke out of the normal tendency whereby rising population absorbs increased resources and then overshoots it to create a crisis through the intersection of war, famine and disease. This is what I call the Malthusian trap. It's a trap which does not absolutely destroy a civilization, but it inhibits and undermines it. The solution to the question of why England and Japan early escaped from the Malthusian constraints turned out to lie in a combination of chance factors, in particular stemming from their island nature. Since finishing the book in 1996, it's become increasingly clear to me that the Malthusian trap is only one part of the story. Its power cannot be understood without looking at other elements such as politics, law, social structure, and knowledge systems. So in a series of subsequent books, I've tried to look at the escapes from parallel traps, which combined in the past to make the Malthusian one so deadly. The second voyage, with the analogy of Captain Cook, was to explore the political and social foundations of modernity in my book, The Riddle of the Modern World, published in 2000 with its subtitle of Liberty, Wealth and Equality. I looked at the work of three great thinkers who asked the same central question as to that which lay behind the Savage Wars of Peace. This question is, how was it possible to escape from a world of war, famine, disease and poverty into one of relative liberty, wealth and equality? Montesquieu, Adam Smith and Tocqueville all gave answers which help us to understand how England and then America escaped from a series of traps as vicious as that outlined by Malthus. This is the normal tendency for increased resources to feed not only into growing population and hence war, famine and disease, but also into increased social inequality and political centralization and authoritarianism. These three great thinkers, Montesquieu, Smith, and Tocqueville, outlined the ways in which it was possible for something to occur which avoided the almost universal tendency which they had observed in every preceding civilization in history. They produced answers to these difficult questions by employing a wide and comparative historical approach which placed Europe, Asia, and America alongside each other so that they were able to note what was common and what was different. So they provided a coherent story of the political and social underpinnings of that material and demographic transformation described in Savage Wars. Thus, Riddle can be read as another attempt to explore how our world came into being. The third voyage was in my book, The Making of the Modern World, Visions from West and East. Even at the end of the riddle, however, there were several unfinished arguments. One concerned the peculiar case of England and the nature of the bonds that hold people together in a capitalist civilization. Montesquieu, Smith, and Tocqueville had pointed to the peculiar legal and social system in England, in particular its development of extensive associations or civil society, as it would now be called. Yet none of these authors had a sufficient knowledge of English history to be able to explore exactly how or why England had developed in this peculiar way. In The Making of the Modern World, published in 2002, I explored this theme through an examination of the greatest of English historians, to my mind, F.W. Maitland. I considered his work as a contribution to political philosophy and social history rather than as legal history, as he's usually taken to be. Maitland explained with great clarity when and why English society, polity, family system, and law diverged from continental systems. In his later work, he outlined the origins of civil society and modern liberty through the elaboration of the device and concept of the trust. While Maitland outlined a satisfying answer to how our modern world emerged, I felt it would also be valuable to look at the answers provided by European thinkers from outside the system. In other words, people who were aware of European thought but not European. How plausible were their ideas when they looked from non-European perspective? Since Japan is the alternative civilization described in Savage Wars, it seemed appropriate to take a Japanese thinker. And in the second half of The Making, I analyze the life and work of the greatest of modern Japanese social thinkers, Fukuzawa Yukichi. Fukuzawa recognized the central essence of what thinkers from Montesquieu to Maitland had stressed. That is the combination of tensions and balances which created the dynamism and openness of Britain and America. He explained how this system worked and helped his countrymen to to import many of its institutional underpinnings in education, commerce, clubs, and elsewhere. So he helped to provide the right context for the importation of Western science and technology. Within a generation, Japan had moved from being a relatively weak agrarian civilization on the edge of China to becoming the first industrial nation in Asia, powerful enough to defeat both China and Russia at war. If there was a demonstration of the accuracy of a set of social theories, this was it. To conclude on the first three voyages. So between 1996 and 2000, I tried to understand how some nations have escaped from two further traps which feed into the Malthusian one: the political, authoritarian centralization, and the social, hierarchical inequality. One further major trap remained unexplored, however. This was alluded to right at the end of the riddle in the following way. There is still a large gap in the explanation of how the transition to the modern world has occurred. Overcoming the Malthusian trap is part of the story, and I have tried to provide a theory to explain how that happened. Partially overcoming political, religious, and social predation is another part of the total picture, and the riddle has provided a theory as to how that may have occurred. Yet there is a third trap which needs consideration. In order to complete the picture, we need a thorough examination of the conditions which lead certain societies to go through an industrial revolution and others an industrious one, some to go through a wisdom revolution and others through a knowledge, scientific one. Or put it another way, why did technological and scientific growth occur so spectacularly and rapidly in Western Europe between about the 12th and 19th centuries? And why, during the same period, did it slow down, cease, and even partially regress in other civilizations which had previously been far more advanced, inverted commas, than Europe? So, nothing daunted, I set out on another expedition, this time with a fellow mariner, Jerry Martin, trying to explore the scientific and technological solution to this question or puzzle. This is what one might call the Mandarin trap, after Chinese mandarins. In other words, the tendency for knowledge systems to become more rigid and conservative with time. It's rather similar to the other three addressed above. Resources and wealth accumulates as a result of chance or invention. This not only feeds into population growth and political and social inequalities, but it also puts more power into the hands of the intellectuals. It tends to increase the control of the lay and clerical forces who guard the thought systems of civilization. There is a very strong tendency towards conservatism, a looking to the past and the known truths among the literate. The past is littered with different examples of this tendency: the Christian Inquisition, Brahmin control of thought in India, the Confucian educational system, the dominance of mullahs at certain periods in Islamic civilizations, religious purity, social status, and political expediency all tend towards suppression of intellectual innovation. Yet we know that, counter to this normal tendency, at some period between about 1200 and 1700 AD, a radical break in systems of thought did occur. A number of revolutionary shifts in method and substance came about, to which we attach the labels the Renaissance and the Scientific Revolution. An open system of understanding and representing the world was instituted or reinstituted. This, in turn, was to provide the foundation for the new biology, chemistry, physics, and medicine, without which the escape from the Malthusian, the political, and the social traps described in the earlier volumes could not have triumphed or been sustained. To understand how and why this had happened is indeed a daunting task to which many have devoted their lives without conspicuous success. How could one approach such a vast subject, the revolution in Western paradigms of knowledge that led to the divergence of Europe from all other civilizations? Furthermore, if one did find parts of an answer, how could one present one's findings in a brief and comprehensible form? Jerry Martin and I decided to focus our analysis on part of the problem, an exemplar or typical case, and one which seemed to lie at the heart of any solution to the question of what happened to shake Europe out of its tendency towards that dogmatic slumber of which Kant spoke. In a short book on the social history and effects of glass, we describe the great divergence between an increasingly glass-saturated Western Europe and an increasingly glassless world outside Europe. We suggest that while glass alone is obviously not a necessary and sufficient cause for the transformation of the quality of reliable knowledge, yet it did have an amazing effect. It created a revolution in human systems of knowledge when joined with some of the other demographic, political, and social elements outlined in previous volumes, and also the inheritance of tools of thought and accumulated information which flowed through Islam from Asia and the ancient world. It allowed a major shift in vision and confidence. In our book, The Glass Bathyscape, How Glass Changed the World of 2002, we argued that glass made a new science and technology possible by providing the new instruments, microscopes, telescopes, barometers, thermometers, vacuum flasks, retorts, and many others. At a deeper level, it literally opened people's eyes and their minds to new possibilities and turned Western civilization from the oral or hearing mode to the visual mode of interpreting experience. In the appendix to the book, we examine 20 famous experiments which have changed our world, chosen at random. 15 of them could not have been performed without glass tools. Putting it in another way, the collapse of glass manufacture in Islamic civilizations and the fading away in India, Japan, and China made it impossible that they could have had the type of knowledge revolution that occurred in Western Europe. The following sciences, we argue, could not have existed without glass instruments: histology, pathology, protozoology, bacteriology, molecular biology. Also, astronomy, the more general biological sciences, physics, mineralogy, engineering, paleontology, volcanology, and geology would have been very different. Without clear glass, there would have been no gas laws, no steam engine, no internal combustion engine, no electricity, no cameras, and no television. Without clear glass, we would not have had the visualization of bacteria, little understanding of infectious diseases, and that understanding which we call the medical revolution, originating with the work of Pasteur and Koch. Without the chemistry, which depended crucially on glass instruments, we would have had no understanding of nitrogen, and so no artificial nitrogenous fertilizers. Much of the agricultural advance of the 19th century would not have occurred without glass. There would have been no knowledge of the moons of Jupiter, and no obvious way to prove that Copernicus and Galileo were right. We would have had no understanding of cell division or of cells, no detailed understanding of genetics, and certainly no discovery of DNA. Without spectacles, a majority of the population in the West over the age of 50 would not have been able to read normal books. So glass is both a giant and unforeseen accident, and at the same time it follows a predictable pattern of movement around a triangle, as Jerry described it. That is, starting at the top, a deeper knowledge of the world at a deep level of principle, then using that to innovate particular objects, and then changing one or two objects into a multiplication or a manufacture on a large scale, and then these objects diffusing through society and coming back to making the knowledge more available. You can see it, for instance, famously in Moore's law of computing. The chips, the knowledge of the deeper principles of mathematics and computing increase, embedded in discoveries and innovations in chip manufacture and other things. They are mass-produced. The power of this goes back into knowledge, and the power of computing increases, doubles every 18 months. The movement round this triangle in relation to glass was confined to one region of the world, that is Western Europe. Yet it was powerful enough to make the world we live in. It could only do so, however, as part of that package of demographic, political, and social patterns outlined in the other books described above. If the modern world is like a garden barred by a combination lock, then unlocking the gate requires the accidental coming together of a series of different numbers which could neither be designed nor left entirely to chance. Yet, even now, the discovery and the voyages of discovery were not over, and I made a fifth journey in a book I co-wrote with my mother, Iris McFarlane, called Green Gold, The Empire of Tea. For the quest was not over. Returning to the most puzzling question behind Savage Wars of Peace, the strange improvement of health in England and Japan in the early modern period, I've had further thoughts. Part of my explanation in Savage Wars for this previously unexplained change was that the introduction of tea drinking was a primary factor behind the hitherto unexplained fall in mortality in 18th century Britain. Hence, I argued that tea drinking allowed the industrial and urban revolution to occur for the first time. This was published in Green Gold in 2003. The television series, which featured the argument The Day the World Took Off, spurred a publisher to ask my mother, a tea manager's widow, and I to write a general book on the history and effects of tea. Research for that book has deepened my conviction that the link between the transition from agrarian civilizations to our modern industrial world does indeed, to a considerable and surprisingly large extent, hinge on the accidental discovery of tea drinking. The theme is explored in the new book, which also contains a wider survey of the effects of tea on health. To my considerable surprise, recent work on the medical effects of tea suggests that a number of other diseases may also be influenced by tea drinking. I had argued previously that it was the waterborne diseases of dysentery, cholera, typhoid, but further research suggested that tea drinking may also have an effect on malaria, influenza, bubonic plague, and various skin and eye diseases. It has also been suggested with some evidence that tea drinking may lower the incidence and effects of many degenerative conditions which I had not dealt with, such as gout, stone, arthritis, teeth decay, heart attacks, strokes, and various cancers. It's worth singling out one of these for further comment. One of the most striking yet puzzling findings in Savage Wars was that malaria seemed to have more or less disappeared in Japan between the 14th and 17th centuries. Likewise in Britain, where malaria had been a serious endemic ailment in the 17th century, it seems to have receded rapidly after about the first third of the 18th century in England and southern Scotland. For example, writing at the start of the 19th century, Thomas Place noted that, quote, the ague, that is malaria, too had its victims in large numbers. Towards the close of the 17th century, nearly one in 40 of those who were buried in London are stated to have died of this disorder, which is now, and he's writing beginning of the 19th century, but seldom heard of and kills nobody. Even those counties where it was most prevalent and most fatal are comparatively free from it, it being confined to much smaller spaces. End of quote. I put forward various theories which experts have suggested in the past to account for this disappearance. Better irrigation and land drainage, which reduced the number of stagnant pools where mosquitoes breed. Changes in livestock rearing, which altered the relations between mosquitoes, livestock, and humans. Mosquito netting in Japan. None of these is satisfactory as a total explanation, even when they are joined together. In light of the fact that some early writers from the 17th century argued that that malaria could be cured or decreased in its effect by tea drinking, as well as the exact correlation between the growth of tea drinking and the decline of malaria on both these islands. It would seem worth re-examining this topic. It's known that certain plants contain substances that are effective against malaria. For instance, the neem tree in India and Artemisia in China, as well, of course, as cinchona bark or quinine. Perhaps there is something similar in the tea camellia. It would certainly be worth future research. For instance, an epidemiological study might confirm whether after the introduction of tea drinking into Assam after the 1880s, or into India from the 1920s, the levels of malaria declined even without spraying or netting, or whether countries which are tea drinking, such as China or Japan, have lower incidence than those without tea. Even within a population, for instance Sri Lanka, there are considerable differences in the incidence of malaria. Does this coincide at all with the incidence of tea drinking? It would be very good to see whether experiments showed any effects of tea on malarial parasites. Although I dealt with China in the Savage Wars of Peace, insofar as I did so, I assumed that it more or less conformed to the Malthusian crisis model of high mortality, epidemic and periodic, and high fertility through young age at marriage, both for males and females. Recent research has suggested that my assumptions may be wrong. In particular, the work of James Lee and his associates suggests the following characteristics of Chinese demography over the period from, say, 1700 to 1900. Mortality was fairly low, roughly in line with that in England or Japan. Famine and subsistence crises were not that widespread. Marital fertility was lower than that in Europe, and roughly in line with Japan, while women married very young, in their early teens. Men married late, in their late 20s or later, and many never married at all. Female infanticide rates were very high, averaging between 10 and 20% of all live births. If this reappraisal is right, and it has been challenged, Chinese demography turns out to be different from both Europe and Japan, but certainly not a simple high mortality and high fertility regime. In the context of health, what is particularly interesting is the low mortality rate. Like Japan, much of the best land in China was densely populated, and there were huge cities. As in Japan, or later 18th century England, there is the intriguing questions of how mortality, particularly that caused by waterborne diseases, was kept in check in a situation where we would have expected to be increasing problems of dysentery, typhoid and other ailments. In Green Gold, we have widened our argument, suggesting that the spread of tea drinking in China from the 8th century onwards may be an important factor in the rise of the Tang and the Song empires by allowing dense populations without serious waterborne diseases. This, we argue, may be due not only to the universal use of boiling water in China, but also because of the antibacterial substances in the tea. If, as we suggest in the book, tea may also inhibit a range of other diseases, including influenza, malaria, and possibly even bubonic plague, as well as common diseases such as strokes, heart attacks, and cancers. The reason for the surprisingly good health of the Chinese population may be connected to tea drinking in a much more dramatic way than merely the boiling of water. Certainly, this was the opinion of the Chinese themselves. As we quote at some length in Green Gold, both the Chinese themselves, from the 8th century onwards, and the missionaries and diplomats who visited China from the 16th century, believed that the longevity and healthfulness of the Chinese was largely to be accounted for by tea drinking. Just to quote one among many examples, in a herbal by Li Shi Chen, published in 1578, but thought to contain material from a much earlier period, Li stated that tea would, quote, promote digestion, dissolve fats, neutralize poisons in the digestive system, cure dysentery, fight lung diseases, lower fevers, and treat epilepsy. Tea was also thought to be an effective astringent for cleaning sores and recommended for washing the eyes and mouth. End of quote. A further way in which work on tea drinking fits into the theses in Savage Wars is also worth mentioning. There's a good deal in the book on tea, on work, on the immense toil of pre-industrial life. In order to sustain the dense populations of Japan and China, very intensive wet cultivation was necessary, wet rice cultivation, often on a meager diet without much protein or even many vegetables. In Green Gold, it is suggested that tea drinking, by providing extra energy through the effects of caffeine on human muscle coordination and endurance, may have played an important part in making such agriculture possible. Furthermore, it is known that green tea contains high levels of vitamin C, and it may also contain enzymes which help the body to extract the maximum of vitamin C from fruit and vegetables, and help, among other things, to reduce scurvy. All of this is an important part of the health environment explored in Savage Wars, just as the stimulating effects of the caffeine in tea, combined with the energy in sugar, we argue, are crucial to understanding what happened when enormous demands were put on generally ill-nourished workers during the British Industrial Revolution. Since completing Savage Wars of Peace in the summer of 1996, I have learnt one more thing about tea which alters an argument in that book. As noted, I argued that the polyphenols in tea destroyed harmful bacteria in water, for example those associated with dysentery and typhoid, and this has been confirmed. This added to the effects of boiling the water to make tea and reduced waterborne disease. Yet I remained puzzled when I wrote the book as to how tea drinking by the mother could have protected breastfeeding infants. For one of the most striking facts about the sudden decline in waterborne dysentery in the middle of the 18th century, as it's been charted by the Cambridge Group, was that it occurred not only among those who drank tea for the first time, mothers and fathers, but equally among infants in their first months. Trying to understand this, I suggested in the book that the link was a negative one. The mother was less likely to have dysentery, so her nipples and hands and clothes would have fewer harmful bacteria. So the infant would be less likely to get the disease. Later, a doctor I talked to explained to me that what a mother eats or drinks will almost immediately be passed on to the suckling infant. As a result, the antibacterial polyphenols in the tea will pass easily into the mouth and stomach of the baby. Hence, the tea drinking of the mother could well have given the breast-fed infant direct extra protection. This would explain why it was both maternal and infant mortality from waterborne disease that simultaneously declined alongside each other. It is yet another argument against feeding infants with dried milk products in those many societies which still suffer so terribly from waterborne infections. My conclusion to the five voyages is perhaps worth stating. A further part of the answer to the question of how the modern world came about is now in place with the tea book. During the last 500 years, one civilization and then others which have copied it have at last temporarily perhaps deviated from the normal tendencies and traps which halt the increase in the wealth of nations. The Malthusian link between production and reproduction has been weakened. The almost inevitable connection between increasing wealth and increasing political and social predation has been partially suspended. The powerful tendency towards intellectual rigidity has been temporarily lifted by developments in the methods of generating and transmitting accurate knowledge about the world. This is not, of course, to say that these tendencies will not reassert themselves in the future. What has happened was the result of chance rather than design, and there are plenty of examples of reversals. Not least among them are that in the middle of the 20th century, most of the nations on Earth, including most of those in Europe, as well as China, Japan, and Russia, were governed by people who were explicitly trying to destroy the liberty, equality, and openness which earlier thinkers had valued, believed to be so valuable. History has certainly not ended. Indeed, many of the tendencies, for instance, the continued massive onrush of population growth, the spread of new and old diseases, the spending of huge quantities of money on weapons and aggressive defense systems are all too obvious. It is my hope, however, that this interconnected set of volumes and their simple synthesis in my book, Letters to Lily, on How the World Works, published a little later after this talk. This set of volumes, of which Savage Wars is one essential pillar, will give a broad outline to some of the dangers which history reveals to us and also of the underlying patterns and tendencies which have again and again caused infinite misery and the collapse of civilizations. James Riley, in his review of Savage Wars, suggests that other nations were not in a position to emulate the English or Japanese model, which allowed an escape from agrarian poverty. This is obviously true of the 18th and even of the 19th century. But we now live in a different world where ideas, technologies, cultures and social systems can move around pretty quickly. It does not seem beyond the bounds of human creativity and rationality to be able to learn a little from our past and to build on this knowledge a safer, wealthier and more just future based on an understanding of what those structural tendencies are which we must avoid and how they have successfully been evaded from time to time. Epilogue, the account and the log, the life of an orphan. So the republication of my book, Savage Wars, in paperback form gives me the opportunity to create an unusual set of materials. The central text is the standalone book, which I showed to the audience. This is a retrospective and edited account of an adventure or exploration. The published account of the voyage of discovery, written after it was finished. In fact, this is the autobiography of a book which is on the web. Alongside this, there's a website which contains various contextualizing elements and materials. It contains a fuller account of why and how the book was written in the very moment when the search for solutions was in progress. If one carries on the metaphor of Captain Cook, they are the diary or log of the voyage as it happened, interspersed with various tentative plans and sketch maps of possible ways to go. There are also descriptions of a number of the paths down which I strayed and on which I found curious facts, but which were finally left out of the published work. Finally, to give some sense of the author and his search, there are 12 short films on the website. In these I pursue the puzzles narrated in the book on location in Japan, Nepal, Australia, Venice and England. More widely, the whole adventure is, as described, but one voyage which fits in with the others to understand the interlinked nature of the unlikely escape into the modern world, as you will see on my website, www.alanmacfarlane.com.